When the leader's over, there we go. Okay. So you actually, at least that time, weren't landed in Russia.
Oh, well, they took us in for a matter of days, and then we never left the...
you were just aboard the destroyer the whole time.
Yeah, we weren't there like some of the poor buggers out that were there for months. There were some of them there for months. Some were in the hospital.
And earlier you said that you had felt that there were only two destinations. One was England and one was Russia.
Yeah.
So had you gone to Russia before?
No.
That was the only trip to Russia. Where did you go in England?
Oh, Liverpool, Cardiff. Oh, that's in Wales.
Yeah.
Cardiff, Swansea. South End on the Seas, Tilbury, south of London, in the Thames, Glasgow, and also that was Scotland.
Ah, come on, that's Ireland. Everybody knows Glasgow's that. Really Ireland. Glasgow and Boston.
You might as well be the back alleys of Dublin.
So, when you went to England, did you find that the social climate was very receptive to the American seamen?
Oh, yes. I've
outside of that nice gentleman that said, oh, you're two American seamen, go ahead and get the eggs.
No, that we were... we were, I think, very well received in England. Of course, we all had girls there. That's
now
main.
The truth.
When you're 18 years old, that's all you think about.
Did you have one of those Coast Guard passes that said Captain of the Port of New York or something, that you tried to convince them that that's what you were?
we're loading ballast one time in a place called Barrie, and this friend of mine, Jacobson, I speak of, he and I were having a beer, and the barmaid came over and said, what ship? Asked what she was, pointed out the window, the one down there. And she said, what do you do there? And we said, well, we're ABs. Oh, she said, I'm glad to hear that there's some ABs on the ship, because I thought they were all third mates. And she said, I said, what are you talking about? And she says, that one there, and that one there, and that one there, and that one there. They all told me they were third mates. But no, the captain of the port, I didn't try to. They used to give us our discharges. Used to say, Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation, Department of Commerce. Then halfway through the war, the Coast Guard took over the issuing of papers, and it was still the Bureau of Marine Inspection and Navigation, United States Coast Guard. Then in big letters it said Certificate of Discharge. Well, this same Jacobson and myself, he was from the Boston area. We were trying to get on a train at Grand Central for Boston, and trains were crowded, and they said to servicemen first, and so I thought, bullshit. I pulled out my Coast Guard discharge, and the two of us went up and said, see, we've been discharged. And look at it, the stupid conductor bought it. So,
well, you had been discharged.
Yeah, didn't tell them a lot. what used to annoy us quite a bit, one of the small annoyances, was that servicemen would get a reduced fare on the train. And if I remember right, I think the train fare from Boston to New York was $5, and $5 and change. And a couple of us, we decided we wanted to go someplace besides England, so we thought Boston, that New York would be better to ship out of. And we went down, of course, got a ship going right back across the North Atlantic. But then we'd have to take the train. When we get to the train station, servicemen who might be stationed in Fort Dix or out on Long Island could ride, get preference of getting on the train at a reduced rate. And it was $2 less or whatever it was. And that was one of the small annoyances.
On the other hand, they didn't get the same rate of pay that you
well,
did.
Well, that's
so.
True, but that is a... that in itself you could write a book about. The wages in the merchant marine were the same wages that were prevailing in 1940 and 41. There was no wage increase until 45. There was a bonus given. It was 100. The bonus was 100% of your wages. But the bonus only applied to the from the time you left the United States till you got back. And then it was broken down. There was 100% bonus area, 70%, and 30%. But it only applied to the time that the ship was actually outside the limit. But once once a ship was sunk or torpedoed or bombed or sunk for whatever reason, your wages stopped immediately on that day. So men who spent 2 weeks in a lifeboat or 42, like the men of the Roger Taney, they weren't paid, their wages weren't paid. Then the time between ships, there was no compensation for that. If you left the ship for whatever reason, your wages stopped when you left the vessel and did not resume till you rejoined. Whereas the Navy, they were making a Navy sailor was making $54 a month, a merchant AB was making $100 a month, but the Navy man's pay would go on for the full 12 months in the year.
Yeah.
So when, and then they had their, they had what was called a C bonus. It was 10 or 20% of their wages, but that went on for the full year as long as they were attached to a ship. Whether they were import, on leave, or wherever. So when it was finally broken down and analyzed, and
There was a differential, but it was not nearly as great as it was made out to be.
No, it was not. Of course, if whatever point you were trying to prove, if you're trying to prove the merchant seaman made tremendous money and the Navy men didn't, if it was slanted, they'd take the wages of a captain or a chief mate on a merchant ship and compare it to a seaman third or a seaman second class or first class in the Navy. Well, that's like comparing the wages of a skilled engineer against a bus driver or a...
Yeah.
There was a congressman from... Chicago, I believe, who made a study of it, and it's somewhere in the congressional record. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy. Where when it was broken down over a year or 2 year period, the amount of difference in the money of people of equal rank was insignificant.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad to know that, because that has not been brought out mm-hmm. before. All they've ever talked about is, well, we got bonuses and they didn't, and, you know, that sort of thing. And
well, even with the bonuses...
Your pace stopped and theirs went on, it evened out in the long run.
Well, the Roger Taney was torpedoed in the South Atlantic. Captain Thomas Potter was the master. And they spent 42 days. There were no men lost on the ship. They spent 42 days, the merchant crew and the Navy, in lifeboats before they were picked up off the coast of Brazil. And it's one of the records after Captain William Bligh, or Lieutenant William Bligh. It's one of the records for sailing in a lifeboat. And all of the men, all the merchant crew in the lifeboat, wages stopped the day the torpedo went into the ship, and they didn't resume until they boarded another ship after a period of hospitalization and rehabilitation. But the Navy men in the same boat, their wages went on. So
quite literally in the same boat.
Yeah, really in the same boat. So the money in hand at the time was a great difference, but at the final analysis, I don't think there was too much. You hear these fantastic wages that the seamen made, but to me, is a lot of BS. The wages for an able seaman who was supposed to have 3 years' experience was $100 a month. And that represented 7 days a week, 30 days a month, or for whatever length of time he was on the ship. They did pay overtime at a rate of 90 cents an hour, but there was not that much. There was no Saturdays or Sundays. Everything was in excess of 8 hours. One of the big overtime treats would be dumping garbage. And that, didn't you say dumping garbage? Well, what we would do, all of the trash, and we didn't accumulate trash in those days, as we did, would be piled on deck on either the port or starboard side aft of the house. And we had coal-burning galleys, so that would give us a lot of ashes, and that would be dumped. And a few ships, not too many, were coal-burning ships, and this stuff would be piled on deck. And then from a signal from the convoy commodore would tell us whether or not we could dump it. And it was usually, if I remember right, it was done a half or an hour after darkness set in. And the theory was, you couldn't dump it periodically because you would leave a trail. Then if situations were right, then I now assume that the Commodore got the word that there were no subs in the area, then all of the ships at a given time at night after darkness would dump it so that it would remain in one place. The subs could know that a convoy had passed, but they wouldn't have a trail if everyone was doing it independently. So for this was one of the treats. You dump garbage and it took you an hour, no more than that, and you got 90 cents for it. So the fallacy of high wages is a lot of nonsense.
Now, you were torpedoed in PQ-17. Were you ever hit on another ship?
Yes, and in the March of 1943.
And which ship was that?
That was the Benjamin Harrison.
Oh. That was the Benjamin Harrison, and that's why you knew so much about which Benjamin Harrison. Uh-huh. And that was en route to England?
Yeah, of course, yes. Mm-hmm.
And did...
No, Africa.
Oh, that was Africa.
Oh, yeah.
And you obviously got out of that one alive. Were there any others lost at that point?
I think there was 11 men.
Mm-hmm.
I can look it up.
Well, it'll be in the...
Yeah.
In the Moore book.
Yeah.
And were you then... In a lifeboat again for a period?
Oh, just a few hours, and they picked us up. Yeah.
So you.
I had no long.
Mm-hmm.
54 hours is the worst because it was cold.
Yeah. Was there any talk that you heard about any practices or circumstances that would make a vessel lucky or unlucky?
Oh, no. Some people were superstitious. Some fellows had the idea of one trip, one ship, get off because it's going to get it. And other people had the idea, one ship is just as safe as the other. If it made it through this time, I'll make it through again. No, there's a little superstition and nothing to base it on, really.
Uh-huh. So you heard some of this, but you never paid any attention to it.
Oh, you get somebody to say, don't never get on a ship with a named after a woman. That was another one. I'm trying to think of some of them now. They were, there were some ships, so they'd have clannish ships, like if a ship came out of the Gulf, Mobile, it'd be Mobile. Don't sail with the Yankees because they're unlucky, or some silliness like that. And one ship was called the Francis Asbury. And it was named after the first Methodist minister in the United States, I believe. And I remember they called for a crew for that, and somebody said, you never want some old hard-bitten type guys here. You never want them to go on a ship named after any Jesus screamer. But any of the suspicions were not well thought out or well founded.
What was the ethnic makeup of the crews that you sailed with? Were there international crews?
I don't know if this is acceptable today, but there was a lot of racial prejudice on ships, and this was divided down by unions. The most democratic, if that's a good word, I would say was the NMU.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were the first ones to face the problem and try to rectify it. I won't speak of the Pacific because I didn't sail out here until 1950, so I... New England has sort of stuck to ships out of the north in the Gulf. There'd be Mobilians in Alabama, and there'd be that crowd. And they didn't seem to mix too well. racially, the SIU, they didn't have any black men on deck or in the engine room. They had black men in the steward's department, and if they were black, if it was a black, it would either be a black steward's department or a white steward's department. They would not do what they called checkerboard. But it was not, let's say it was an accepted thing. No, it was just the way it was. No one ever questioned it. You can question the theory of it, but it was in practice. Now, as far as international, if you got a ship out of Boston, it would be basically, it would be New England men, majority. And then if you got it out of the Gulf, it would be Mobile men. If you got it out of New York, it would be more of a mixture. Now, where aliens would come in, or non-U.S. citizens, a lot of them would be survivors of foreign ships that had been torpedoed, and they would have nowhere to go. For instance, a Norwegian, if he lost his ship, then the U.S. government, when they had agencies, they would get him an American seaman's document, and then he would ship on an American ship. And basically, these were more skilled, not entry ratings. They would be able seamen or oilers or somebody with skill. And then I would say in the start of 43, there was more, you'd get more and more of them. In fact, there was even instances of foreign officers who were given temporary licenses, or waivers, as they called them.
Mm-hmm. Was there any tension between the different groups?
Oh, not real tension. You'd get some old boxhead, as I like to call them, who would always think that they were superior because they were, had this mystique about them being better seamen. But a lot of the younger, younger guys, myself in particular, I was always fascinated by them because they had so many different tales to tell. Some of them had, you know, been on whalers, and some of them had been to some of the most god-awful. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Wait a minute.
Well, I hope.
End of interview, end of tape C781, Northeast Archives of Folklore and Oral History, accession number 2196.